I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, it's not just the White House that's up for grabs in 08. It's the House as well. We'll take a look at congressional races. But first, two U.S. and one British scientist have won this year's Nobel Prize in Medicine for groundbreaking discoveries that led to a technique called gene targeting, manipulating genes in mice, now widely used to study the role of genes in heart disease, diabetes, cystic fibrosis, and cancer. The prize is shared by Mario Kopecky of the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, Oliver Smithies of the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and Sir Martin Evans of Cardiff University in Wales. The Nobel is particularly striking achievement for Kopecky, a native of Italy. He was separated from his mother at the age of four when she was taken to the Dachau concentration camp as a political prisoner during World War II. He said today that he was deep asleep this morning at 3 a.m. when he got the call. He said the fellow on the other end sounded serious, so he thought it must be real, and he is thrilled.
It's fantastic, though. It's a great surprise, and it's a marvelous honor for the people that work with me in my lab and also our department and our university.
Nobel Prize winner Mario Kopecky earlier today. Well, Wall Street Journal reporter Jacob Goldstein, also author of the paper's health blog, is with us. And, Jacob, we understand the work that these three men did stretched back 20 years. So, first of all, what is this process of gene targeting?
Well, gene targeting really arose out of two different strains of research. One of them was being carried on by Kopecky and Smithies, and the other one by Evans. And in the mid to late 1980s, they sort of came together to give rise to gene targeting. Kopecky and Smithies were using a process that actually occurs naturally. The simple term that you'll hear for it in undergrad biology classes is crossing over. And this is a way that the bodies of mammals, humans, and other mammals naturally sort of shuffle up the genes a little bit to increase genetic diversity. And Kopecky and Smithies figured out that you could use this natural process in the lab, in the petri dish essentially, as a way of tweaking genes for experimental purposes.
In fact, they took genes from certain mice and put those in mouse embryonic stem cells and injected them into mouse embryos?
Yes, that's right. The embryonic stem cell piece was what Evans had been working on. So basically, Kopecky and Smithies had figured out a very powerful way to manipulate genes, and the work of Evans was a way to get the work that they were doing in the petri dish into animals, in this case, into mice.
What happened after they injected this altered genetic material into these mouse embryos?
Well, ultimately, what they were able to do in combining their techniques was create mice with targeted changes in the genes. So a scientist could say, most importantly, I want to make a mouse with this particular gene inactivated so I can understand what it does. And indeed, in the late 80s, they were able to do that, which has proved over the ensuing decades to be a very powerful scientific method to do medical research on particular genes.
Give us a sense of, you know, how this can be applied.
Well, there's a pretty wide range of applications. One very clear-cut application that has been developed using this technique is for studying cystic fibrosis, which is tied to a very particular gene. So by creating a mouse that lacks this gene that is closely connected to cystic fibrosis, researchers have been able to create a really good model to allow them to study the disease by looking at these mice.
Now, we've been mentioning embryonic stem cells. We understand that the way they were used in this research is very different from the way they're proposed to be used in human research, where embryonic stem cells would be used to grow certain tissues.
That's right. The applications are quite different. And this is really a research technique that applies to mice. Certainly, there are powerful traits that embryonic stem cells have that make them of interest, both in terms of human embryonic stem cells and of mouse embryonic stem cells. But it would be a mistake to connect too closely this research with research that people are interested in doing on human embryonic stem cells.
Well, we just want to mention each of the winners is, of course, accomplished. But Kopecky's story is amazing. Apparently, after he was separated from his mother at the age of four by the Gestapo, he lived on the streets. Malnutrition sent him to a hospital. His mother found him again on his ninth birthday. And then they came to the United States. And we understand he didn't speak any English?
You know, I have just been reading about his biography myself. I also understand that his mother was a poet. His father was an Italian Air Force pilot. They had sort of a brief liaison in the late 1930s. It's quite amazing.
And I'm sure we'll be hearing more. Wall Street Journal reporter Jacob Goldstein, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, to our conversation today, the state of Virginia will hold a special election to fill the seat of Republican Congresswoman Joanne Davis, who died on Saturday at 57 after a two-year battle with breast cancer. Davis represented a reliably Republican district in Virginia. In fact, Democrats even put up anyone to challenge her in 2002 and 2004. She was an early supporter of the war in Iraq, who later called for Donald Rumsfeld's resignation. And now, of course, her friends and supporters feel her loss. But secondarily, her death puts another House seat into the mix as the 2008 congressional elections begin to take shape, and that is not good news for Republicans. A new analysis by Congressional Quarterly says it's increasingly likely that Democrats will be able to hold the majority they captured in the House last year, and they might even expand it, even though voters have soured on the democratically led Congress. In the 2006 election, Democrats were expected to pick up some seats because of dissatisfaction with the war in Iraq, but when they won 30 seats, even the pundits were surprised. Bob Benenson is editor of CQPolitics.com. He joins us now. And Bob, do you expect anything that dramatic next year?
No, I don't expect it to happen. But, you know, let's have that big neon lit disclaimer up there, because we didn't know the 30-seat game was going to happen at this point in the 2006 cycle. Mm-hmm. By the fall of 2006, it looked like a pretty likely thing that the Democrats would be able to gain control of the House, but we're looking maybe 2-seat advantage, 3-seat advantage, while they wound up with a 16-seat advantage, because everything just broke their way. The Republicans just never found a way to address the dissatisfaction the public was stating in public opinion polls. This time, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned the Democratic control of Congress is increasingly unpopular, which is true. Overall job approval ratings for Congress are really quite poor. The only problem for Republicans is that they're dragging down the curve. If you drill down one question on those polls, it shows that Republicans are still more unpopular than Democrats in Congress. So that's not really a great footing try and take back Congress. The other thing is, one of the things that's dragging down the Democrats in Congress is that a lot of Democratic activist voters don't think the Democrats are doing enough to fight Republican policy. They don't think they're doing enough to bring the war in Iraq and to reverse President Bush's policies. That doesn't necessarily lend itself to a big swing to the Republicans, because these are voters who still oppose Republican principles. They're just angry that the Democrats aren't doing enough.
Right. So dissatisfaction with the Democrats doesn't mean they're going to turn to the Republicans. But as you point out, many of the Democrats that did take office, in some cases surprisingly last year, took office in largely Republican areas, and also some of these were freshman office holders, and they're usually more vulnerable. So are the Democrats still somewhat vulnerable in those areas?
Oh, sure they are. Most of the freshman Democratic House incumbents were elected in partisan swing districts, and even a few were elected in districts that usually vote very strongly Republican, and often there were special circumstances there. The Republicans had a lot of ethics controversies and scandals prior to the last election, and in some of those districts, such as Mark Foley in Florida, Bob Ney in Ohio, was caught up in the Jack Abramoff scandal. Those are districts that, you know, would be slam dunk, right, no-brainer wins for Republicans, but Democrats hold those seats. So they're going to have to fight for those. The thing about it is that the same kind of really aggressive political strategizing that the Democrats employed in the 2006 campaign is being carried forward to 2008. They're not sitting back. They're not being complacent about these situations. From the very start, about a month into this new Democratic-controlled Congress, the Democrats had already announced the list of potentially vulnerable Democrats, most of them freshmen, who they were going to be giving additional aid and trying to channel more campaign funds to. They've been giving them key committee assignments. They're really giving them upfront roles on pieces of legislation that could benefit them politically in the 2008 campaign.
You point out that the Democrats are working really hard. Are Republicans doing the same thing, looking out, trying to find people to run for office, et cetera?
They are, but, you know, the Republicans are operating under two significant disadvantages. One is the party and the president who represents the party still are doing very poorly in job approval ratings. That doesn't create the kind of atmosphere that makes some promising contenders want to make the leap. The other thing is that the Republican Party National Campaign Committees are really at a tremendous financial disadvantage.
Isn't that interesting?
It is. You know, well, you know, money goes, it flows to the winners. I mean, people want to be on the winning side. The cash on hand disparity, it's about $23 million for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, their House Campaign Committee, versus a little bit more than $1 million for the National Republican Congressional Committee, which conducts their House campaign. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't conduct one top-tier congressional race anymore for $1 million. Now, that leaves them with very little money to spread around. So, taking a step further, if you are the Republicans and the Democrats are being very aggressive and they're saying, we're not only going to try and defend our own seats, we're going to try and take more of yours, that puts them in a position where they have to invest some of their capital, a good part of their capital, just playing defense. That cuts down on the amount of money that they can use as venture capital to try and take over Democratic seats. So it's kind of like a snowball effect. When you lose the majority, you lose some of your financial resources, discourages some people who would rather serve in Congress in the majority than the minority, and it makes that backswing, that back pendulum swing, harder to achieve. You know, often in the years after there's a big swing year like 2006 was, there's some comeback, but very rarely does the pendulum swing all the way back where the party that got kicked out of office gets ushered right back in the next election cycle.
Well, let's take a look at what you project. 50 seats, you say, are up for grabs in the House, and you divide those into different categories, Republican-leaning, Democratic-leaning, safe Republican, safe Democrat. But what's interesting are the 8 seats that are particularly vulnerable. They're sort of, you know, no clear favorites. Which are these seats, and what do you think makes them that way?
One of the interesting factors that's happening this year, on top of all their other problems, is that the Republicans have more retirement so far for the House than the Democrats do. In fact, none of the current Democratic incumbents has announced that he or she is going to retire, to leave office, to go and sit in a rocking chair somewhere. The only two Democrats who are leaving the House are running for the Senate, Tom Allen in Maine and Mark Udall in Colorado. That's so far, of course. The Republicans have several who are just leaving or going into private life. And several of those seats, one that's held by Deborah Price in Ohio's 15th district, that's a Columbus district, she barely held off a Democratic challenge last time. That's a swing district. That's a district where the Democrats expect to seriously compete. Jim Ramstad in suburban Minneapolis. This is a district that the Democrats in Minnesota have been eyeing for years, and then they've made this argument for years that the only reason that district has stayed Republican is that the Republican incumbent, Jim Ramstad, is a very popular moderate, and once he left office, they would have a good shot at winning that seat. Well, they'll get the chance to prove that argument next year because Jim Ramstad is retiring.
That's Bob Benenson, editor of CQPolitics.com. By the way, Jim Ramstad, a recovering addict, is very familiar to people here in New England where we are because he took Rhode Island Congressman Patrick Kennedy, of course, a staunch Democrat, under his wing when Kennedy had substance abuse problems. People here remember that. Well, we're going to have more from Bob, including how immigration is playing out in some congressional races in Arizona and a special election here in Massachusetts where both candidates have suffered a loss. And later in the show, bridges, they inspire phobias in some people, traffic fatigue in others. Music for one composer, he's turning a bridge into an orchestra. We'll have that later as well. Back after a quick break here and now. We're back with more of our conversation about the 2008 congressional elections. Bob Benenson, editor of CQPolitics.com, has been telling us there are 8 seats in the House where there are no clear favorites. 6 of them are held by Republicans. Of the 6 Republicans, 4 are retiring. Jim Ramstad in Minnesota, Deborah Price in Ohio, Rick Renzi in Arizona, and Jerry Weller in Illinois. Renzi and Weller have been dogged by ethical questions, but they say that's not why they are leaving Congress. California Republican John Doolittle is battling some ethical questions as well. He's running for re-election, but will likely face a strong challenge in 2008, as he did in 2006. And that leaves Congressman Robin Hayes in North Carolina. Bob, remind us, what happened in his race last year?
The Democrats kind of gave up on that one early in the 2006 cycle because their favored candidate, an Iraq war veteran, decided that he couldn't financially pursue the race. They wound up with a social studies teacher and a former factory worker and a first-time candidate, and they thought, oh, well, we're not going to be able to compete with Robin Hayes, who's a textile heir and always has an ample campaign treasury. And then, lo and behold, the Democratic candidate, Larry Kissel, turned out to be a strong contender. He only lost by 328 votes. Hmm. What's special about this particular district, it's one of those districts that used to have a thriving textile industry. There's almost none of it left. So free trade, foreign competition. is a big issue in that district. And so the Democrats' appeals that the Republicans are too favorable to free trade that costs American jobs has been a strong arguing point for them in their campaigns.
There's an interesting race here in Massachusetts. It's a special election to fill retiring Democrat Marty Meehan's seat. Nikki Tsongas is running. She's the widow of the very locally popular former presidential candidate Paul Tsongas. She's saying this election is a referendum on George Bush. But she's running against Republican Jim Ogonowski. He's a retired Air Force colonel, and he's a sympathetic character in that his brother was the captain of one of the planes flown from Boston into the World Trade Center on 9/11. And he's also been critical of President Bush's handling of the war in Iraq. What's the significance of this race?
If the Republican candidate, Jim Ogonowski, were to win that seat, that would be a statement that the emotional resonance of the 9/11 disaster is still very strong. That still seems like a bit of a long shot. The district is not the strongest Democratic district in Massachusetts, but still it's about a 56% John Kerry district, looking at his 2004 presidential vote against President Bush. Nikki Tsongas is the widow of the late Senator Paul Tsongas, who had a really strong following, and so there's still lingering sympathy for her because Paul Tsongas died of cancer so prematurely at the age of 55 about a decade ago. The intangible that you always have to look for is turnout. How much attention are people paying to this? How much of a get out the vote operation can you generate in one of these by-elections, these special elections that occur, in the middle of electoral nowhere? This one happens to be taking place on October 16th of the odd-numbered year. So are they going to be able to grab enough attention? Are they going to be able to afford enough media? Now, Nikki Tsongas says as a substantial financial advantage, which should carry her over the finish line, even if the race is a little bit closer than people expect. But it would be regarded as a really big upset and really kind of an anomaly, given the overall public opinion, Democrats versus Republicans, at this point, if Tsongas were to lose. So, we are watching it carefully. These special elections are really often looked at as bellwethers, as omens for how the election is going to play out. They're not necessarily so,
right,
but they're really the only live indicators that we've got.
Right, but in that case, as you said, that may be too particular to those two people in that
yes.
particular area.
Yep.
Well, what about immigration? Just last question. New York Times yep. columnist Timothy Egan recently wrote that Republicans are losing the West. He quoted the Arizona Democratic Party chair saying, "Arizona is in play like never before. The Republicans are literally handing it to us. And according to Democrats, it's because these hardline conservatives are alienating voters with get-tough immigration policies when people care about other things more." But we hear from Arizona listeners on the left and right who care very much about immigration issues. So what do you think is true there?
That's an interesting perspective to suggest that it's a tangential issue. For the people who are really engaged in this issue, it is anything but tangential. They are really engaged in this, and they're fueling certainly the campaign of the long-shot Republican presidential candidate, Tom Tancredo.
But what do your polls show you? Is as the Democratic chair says, Arizona in play? This, what you think of as a red state?
Oh, yes, but for more than one reason. There are demographic changes. Population growth is bringing more moderate voters, tempering the old-fashioned conservatism of these areas. The Democrats are doing a better job at building a party and recruiting more centrist candidates. The Democrats picked up two House seats in Arizona in the 2006 election. Harry Mitchell and Gabriel Giffords both campaigned as moderates.
This is in districts 5 and 8.
That's correct. Right. And a lot of Hispanic Americans view the immigration issue as an attack on them. And the higher pitch the rhetoric and the more identification that the Republican Party has as being, in their minds, anti-immigrant, as opposed to just anti-illegal immigrant, the more that the Hispanics are going to become wedded to the Democratic Party, and the more it's going to motivate Hispanics who have been lagging in political participation to get involved in the political process and become voters, and to become citizens, to become voters. And that is going to weigh heavily down the road, and maybe as soon as 2008, against the Republicans in places where there are heavy immigrant populations, Arizona being one, Texas, California, and then some of the more northerly states that are gaining a lot of Hispanic population. It could create political problems for the Republicans in places where they're dealing with this issue on a day-to-day basis.
Bob Benison, editor of CQPolitics.com. By the way, for a link to CQ's analysis of House races, go to our website, here-now.org. Bob, thanks as always.
You're welcome, Robin.
Okay, looking ahead, tomorrow on Here and Now, the side effect of foreclosures, algae-filled pools, overgrown yards, will meet an Arizona police officer whose new beat is abandoned homes. And still ahead today, could new tensions in Kosovo spur another Balkan refugee crisis? That's right after the news, Here and Now. There are fears of a new refugee crisis in the Balkans. In Kosovo, tensions are rising between the province's 2 million ethnic Albanians and 120,000 Serbs. Albanians, backed by the U.S. and the European Union, are pushing for independence in Kosovo, but neighboring Serbia wants to hang on to its province and is counting on its ally Russia for support. The latest round of talks is set for Sunday. If things don't go well, there are concerns of renewed violence that could end with the minority Serbs fleeing the troubled area. Beth Kamscher covers the Balkans for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us from Sarajevo in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Beth, welcome.
Hi.
There was an incident last Wednesday adding to fears of renewed violence. Can you tell us about that?
Well, Kosovo's public broadcaster, which is kind of their PBS in the province, aired some footage and an interview with members of the Albanian National Army, which has been labeled a terrorist group by the UN in Kosovo, which runs the province. And basically the footage that they got was a group of masked, armed men in black uniforms that were patrolling some highways, stopping vehicles, checking them. And they spoke to RTK, the kind of PBS of Kosovo, and said that they were preparing for a Serbian invasion of the province.
Well, we want to remind ourselves, the UN has run Kosovo ever since NATO bombing drove Serb forces out of that area in 1999. That was following the crackdown by Serb leader Slobodan Milosevic, who forced about 800,000 ethnic Albanians to flee their homes. And now it sounds as if the ethnic Albanians are saying that if they don't get independence through talks between the EU, the United States, and Russia, they're going to seize it anyway.
Well, I would try to keep in mind that this so-called Albanian National Army is very much a splinter group. I mean, you're not going to find most of the 2 million Albanians in the province, you know, wearing masks and stopping cars with AK-47s and things like that. But I would say that this is a symptom of people becoming incredibly impatient over how long this process is taking. I mean, we're 8 years on after the end of the NATO bombing, and the United Nations running the place, and the Albanians are becoming quite impatient. And so I would say that this armed group is more of a symptom of that.
And tell us what some of that frustration is born of. What's it like to live in Kosovo today?
I think for the majority of people, it's incredibly frustrating. Just regular people basically don't make more than $200 or $300 a month, and it's quite expensive there because of the large international presence. I mean, a cup of coffee is something like $2. And they can't travel anywhere because they're a UN-administered province, which means they need visas to even go to kind of next-door countries. You know, the economy is in bad shape. Property restitution hasn't happened. There's no privatization, no foreign investment. It's just an incredibly frustrating limbo for both the Albanians and the Serbs.
The minority Serbs and the majority Albanians. What does fuel the economy?
That's a good question. Basically, I think a lot of Albanians and I guess some Serbs are making money by taking rent from the internationals that live there, you know, several thousand kind of UN personnel, lots of NATO troops there as well, NGOs, that type of thing. But also in my work down there in the last couple of years, you really learn how much the kind of smuggling of cigarettes and, you know, construction material and even Pampers is a really big part of the economy. And also there's an enormous Albanian diaspora that puts in remittances.
None of this money is taxed and can increase a tax base, and that's what is making Kosovo so unattractive to investors from outside of the country. So given all of that, Why is Serbia so intent to hang on to its province? We understand that the EU is offering EU membership if Serbia agrees to let go of Kosovo, but a recent poll shows that 41% of people in Serbia believe that it's more important to keep the province than to enter the EU. So why is that? What's the connection?
Well, that's because Kosovo as a province is a very holy and sacred place to the Serbian mentality. You have dozens and dozens of very ancient, kind of special Serbian Orthodox monasteries, and the province was also the site of a famous battle in 1389 that still looms large in the Serbian consciousness. And so you have all of these kind of emotional issues over the province, even though in general most of the Serbs that I know in the capital city in Belgrade, I'm trying to think if I've ever met anyone who's actually been to Kosovo.
Yeah, so it's more symbolic. And you know, we rush to say that in that same poll, 60% of Serbs do want to join the EU.
Well, that's right. And so that would be a majority. So you see how Serbia is quite split. I mean, not nearly down the middle, but the country is definitely at a crossroads as to whether they go forward into these European Union structures or whether they remain in the past and kind of cling to Russia as a solution.
Well, as we said, talks this week, the UN has set a deadline of December for making this decision. But in the meantime, what do you think is going to happen? We understand there is a report in the newspaper that the Pentagon has asked Croatia if that country was braced for a refugee crisis, meaning this pouring of Serbians out of Kosovo into neighboring areas, which has, of course, raised concerns of violence. What do you think is going to happen?
I do hate to be a doomsayer about these types of things. It's all very much up in the air, and I think the Pentagon and the UN agencies that operate in the region do have contingency plans just in case for this worst-case scenario that could possibly happen. But in general, it's really going to depend on what happens in the next several months with the talks and with the December deadline and whether or not the Albanian leadership in Kosovo is going to make a unilateral declaration of independence.
And one last thought, Beth. Is there a sense in the region that this is sort of the forgotten conflict, that the focus has shifted to Iraq and Afghanistan, almost as if the Balkans was finished, when in fact, as you've pointed out, it's not?
Oh, that's absolutely right. It's far from finished here. And this Kosovo piece of the puzzle is really the last piece that needs to be solved. And with all the attention and resources and military strength and all of those things being focused on Afghanistan, Iraq, it is really the forgotten conflict. And I think that in the last 4 or 5 years, a lot of opportunities have been missed just exactly because not so much attention is focused on it.
Beth Campshire, reporting on the Balkans for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us about renewed fears of violence in Kosovo. She's speaking to us from Sarajevo in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Beth, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And this note, while the Balkans region prepares for a possible refugee crisis, Greece is already in the middle of one. The UN says people fleeing Afghanistan and Iraq account for the greatest surge in asylum seekers in Greece. Many are making their way to Greek islands off the coast of Turkey. The island of Samos has seen the number of illegal immigrants triple this year to about 3,600 people. Police there routinely round up the immigrants and put them in detention centers while they try to figure out if they qualify for asylum. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees has called the migrant reception area on Samos horribly overcrowded and has called on Greece to close that facility. Meanwhile, Greece is having problems sorting out where the refugees are coming from. Thousands claim to be from Iraq and Afghanistan, but they have no paperwork. Officials believe many of them are Kurds from Turkey looking for a way into Europe. And just a reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live at our website, here-now.org. And for past programs, you can click on the archives. And you can also download a podcast and take us with you on this Columbus Day. That's here-now.org. And before we go today, how one man's bridge became another man's orchestra. You're listening to Here and Now. Woo, wudu is the Muslim ritual of washing before prayer, and it's causing some problems in public restrooms as Muslims lift their feet to wash them in sinks and spill water and make floors slippery. Well, now more than a dozen universities and some airports are considering or have added foot baths to public restrooms, and that's raising some questions about separation of church and state. Dr. Jeremy Gunn is the director of the American Civil Liberties Union Program on Freedom of Religion and Belief. He recently wrote an opinion piece in USA Today about all of this, and he joins us now. Dr. Gunn, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, you know, and people might be thinking, okay, ACLU equals separation of church and state, and that may be true, but you come down, what, on the side of foot baths?
Well, I think that in the proper circumstances, a foot bath could be permissible, but the depends certainly on what the circumstances are leading to the creation of that.
In Minneapolis, a Muslim student hurt herself last year while trying to wash her feet in a bathroom sink. Are you saying that it's not about religion as much as it's about safety?
It's about health and safety. Those are the reasons. Let me try an analogy to this. Suppose that there is a busy intersection in front of a mega church, and there's the risk that somebody is going to be hit on the sidewalks, so the town decides to put up a semaphore or put up stop signs in order to promote the safety. Now, that might encourage in some sense, or it may help people go into the mega church, but that doesn't make it unconstitutional if the reason is to promote health and safety. On the other hand, if the town erects a sign saying, please attend the mega church, well, then you've got a different issue. So if it is genuinely for health and safety, and there is not another reasonable accommodation that can be made, then that sort of thing can be permissible. If the school were to say, though, we really think it's a good idea for Muslims to do their prayers and to wash and would like to facilitate that, well, that's a whole different reason, and that's the sort of thing that causes constitutional problems.
You give other examples. For instance, you mentioned the Pope, when the Pope comes to visit.
Yes, I mean, that would be right. If the Pope wants to give a hold mass on the Boston Common, we would want the police to provide the security that's necessary, and that is an expense for public safety. But if the town decided that they wanted to encourage people to attend the mass, that would be an unconstitutional problem.
The University of Michigan Dearborn is going to install 2 foot washing stations, and they're going to pay for it out of student fees. You know, some people question the money. They say, well, you know, shouldn't the population that needs whatever it is, in this case a foot bath, shouldn't they be the ones, you know, footing the bill for it? How do you feel about that?
Well, that becomes a problematic issue, because then we would end up getting into a dispute about, well, what if some students want to set up a monument for the Church of Scientology, or if they want something for Wiccans, or if they want something for Jehovah's Witnesses, as long as the students are paying for it, then they can do it. So that creates a problem as well.
And what do you say to people say, yeah, but where does it stop? Oh, if you have foot baths, well, then do you have to put aside a special area for Muslims to pray? There's an elementary school, Carver Elementary School in San Diego, where they have created a special extra recess so that the Muslim kids can pray.
That is unconstitutional, and the ACLU had discussions with Carver, and as far as I understand, they have dropped that practice.
By your theory, is it really unconstitutional? If you had all sorts of little kids just plopping down prayer rugs across the playground or in the hall, why wouldn't giving them an extra space and time fall under the same guidelines of being a safety issue?
The issue is whether it is specifically accommodating a particular kind of religious practice by holding an extra period where all of the students do this, or particularly encouraging people to pray. That's when the state gets on the side of promoting a religion. And again, it's the same as if the state were saying, no, you can't have your religious beliefs. That would be unconstitutional as well.
The foot baths, you point out that there's no sign on it saying this is a Muslim foot bath. So,
yes.
In fact, anyone could use it for anything.
Yes, the janitor can use it to fill up a wash bucket. People who wear sandals can wash their feet in it. Just as the sink in the restroom is not a ritual object, so the foot bath is not a ritual object. The ritual objects would be certainly problematic constitutionally, but just helping somebody wash themselves is not a problem.
Dr. Jeremy Gunn is the director of the American Civil Liberties Union Program on Freedom of Religion and Belief. Dr. Gunn, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
And coming up, musician Joseph Bertolozzi's new big project is really big, as you'll hear in 1 minute here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Joseph Bertolozzi only plays the big instruments, the pipe organs, gongs. What we're hearing now is his biggest yet, 3,000 feet of it. This piece is called Bridge Funk, and it's played on the suspension cables, road signs, and girders of the Franklin D. Roosevelt Bridge in Poughkeepsie, New York. Also called the Mid-Hudson River Bridge, it's a soaring landmark with tall Gothic towers and elegant cables. It looks sort of like two connected castle drawbridges. But to Joseph Bertolozzi, it's an orchestra of sound. He's composing a piece for the 400th anniversary of Henry Hudson's voyage up the Hudson River in 2009, and he joins us now from Beacon, New York, to tell us more about that process. Welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. This is one of my favorite bridges. Let's try to describe it. It's steel and cables. It almost looks like a castle drawbridge in places because it has this big Gothic tower. How do you see it?
It's a very elegant suspension bridge that was designed in 1925. So it has a little bit of Art Deco to it, very elegant lines. It's a beautiful bridge, and it's not really huge, you know.
When did you get the idea of playing it?
As you said, I have a gong project called the Bronze Collection. I was just coming off a concert, and my wife and I were passing a poster of the Eiffel Tower, and she whimsically took a strike at the poster and went bong. And I said to myself, you know something? That could work.
So tell us some of the sounds that you gathered from the bridge. What surfaces did you play?
Well, we in the very beginning, you hear these like punching type sounds, and those are the very long suspender ropes, the suspension cables that hold the deck up in the air. Right after that, you hear a scrape, which sounds sort of like a Latin instrument. What it is really a drainage grate for rain and snow to fall through. When you hear the bass guitar sound, what you're actually hearing are the very short suspender cables, which I thought would sound like a bell, before I actually went out there and recorded the sounds. But they had turned out sounding like a bass guitar or a bass marimba. And we recorded the handrails, the guardrails, the spindles, the signs that say bridge freezes before roadway. You know, we got pretty much everything underneath the deck, down by the piers. We did pretty comprehensive search.
It's amazing. There's a video on the New York Times website that shows you doing some of this, and you had to do it with the help of, you know, the Bridge Authority and transport commissioners, you know, New York workers who scramble all over these bridges, and they look like they have, you know, rappelling equipment on. Yeah. And they thought you were out of your mind when you first suggested this.
Well, pretty much everybody did. They weren't unique in that sense. I did a lot of research before I went before the Bridge Authority, and I learned the technical language of the different surfaces of the bridge and properties of the metal that was used in this particular bridge, and I spoke to engineers so that when I went and presented the idea of writing music for the bridge, they could see that, you know, I had taken some pains to try to reach them at a realistic level, that it wasn't just a castle in the air kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And when they heard my other compositions, they saw that I was a legitimate composer, and they were interested enough to give me a chance to go out and produce this demo recording, which you're hearing, Bridge Funk, just to prove that the bridge could be turned into a musical instrument.
Let's listen to a little more of it. While we talked to you about how you did this, I mean, it's dangerous for the workers, but it was a little dangerous for you and your recording artist as well. I mean, you have to, you're climbing all over this thing and attaching microphones, sensors to the bridge itself.
Yeah, most of the surfaces that we can play are all reachable from the sidewalk. And this bridge, one of the reasons I chose this bridge is because it does have a sidewalk. And we can reach most of the surfaces from there.
What are you going to do about the higher reaches? Just attach things up there that can record for you?
Anything that's over the handrails, we're going to attach pistons to them that will be driven by a keyboard. So, the percussionists will be playing things that they can reach from the sidewalk, but the things that are up in the air will actually be playing from a keyboard, but struck, you know, percussively from a piston.
Huh. Well, you know, I want to ask you, you know, why a bridge? I mean, we just had this terrible bridge tragedy in Minneapolis. Most people are going around tapping on bridges now to test the infrastructure. Here you are, you know, playing one. What is it about bridges that makes us feel so strongly about them?
There's an element of risk. even if you're not afraid of bridges or heights or water or anything, there's always a little element of risk when you go over it, you know. So we need them. We love them because they connect us to, you know, people on both sides. And like I said, there's always a little element in the background of your mind, probably.
We have a clip from sound artist Bill Fontana's installation of the Millennium Bridge in London.
Yeah.
This is for the Tate Modern last year. Let's hear the sound generated by his sensors on that bridge. It was transmitted back to the museum. Now, this is different because it's vibrations that are picked up, whereas in your case, we see you playing with mallets.
His approach is to just take the natural sounds of the bridge, amplify them, and hear it that way. There's also an artist in Australia, Jody Rose, who's doing a similar kind of thing. My project is different in the sense that I'm writing fixed pieces of music in standard musical notation. Each percussionist will be standing in front of their station, so one guy might be playing, a handrail and a guardrail, and another gal might be playing part of the tower, and they'll be playing fixed pieces of music that are notated, and that could be recreated in the future.
It's more like people who play glasses of water or bell ringers. You've assigned each sound a note.
You've got it, exactly.
Well, and it sounds like a terrific project, but it has an almost $2 million price tag. How are you going to raise that money?
Well, I'm talking to corporate sponsors. I mean, there are companies out there who spend $2 million for a single commercial, that runs once, you know. And this is going to be a concert series that's going to run over an entire weekend. So a corporation that has money to spend for advertising is certainly going to have a tremendous visibility. Mm. Who wouldn't want a billboard that's 3,000 feet long and 300 feet high?
Right. How will the audience hear it? Are they going to stand along the banks, or is the purpose to record it?
No, the actual project and the beauty of this is that it's a live event. I mean, I could record these pieces, these different sounds individually, and then create them in my computer like I did with Bridge Funk. But what we're going to do is, because we have mics on the surfaces, the mics will transmit those sounds to speaker towers on a stage on the shores.
Yeah.
So there will be a festival going on, the Hudson River Arts Festival, and this will be part of that festival, and people will come to it, and we'll do a performance like Friday night, Saturday afternoon, Saturday night, Sunday afternoon, Sunday night. So you'll be hearing it live, and there'll also be a jumbotron in between those speakers, so we'll have video cameras shooting us. So, and another way to pay for this is that, you know, you have a jumbotron when we're not playing, you can have commercials of these corporations that are helping to fund it.
Continuing to make your pitch to the corporation. We thought it was fascinating that Ralph Majewski, who designed this bridge, was a pianist before he became an engineer.
Yeah, he was actually a classmate of Paderewski's.
Huh.
I think he would be thrilled to see that his work of engineering is being used as a musical instrument.
That's musician and composer Joseph Bertolozzi getting ready to take it to the bridge, as James Brown would say, in 2009. His current music is called Bridge Funk. For more on the project and to hear some sound, see a video of Joseph playing the Mid-Hudson Bridge, go to our website, hear-now.org. Joseph, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.